Hi, I'm Charlie Saroff, the cinematographer of Smile 2, and you are watching the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
What's up, Ilya?
Friedman. It's time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Who's on the show today?
Very, very excited. We've had just an embarrassment of riches of horror DPs, and this was our returning champion, Charlie Saroff, who shot Smile 2, which, when I was conducting the interview, was the number one movie in the country. Unfortunately, it was bested by the new Venom movie. But very excited to talk to him nonetheless. I actually saw the movie twice.
Oh, wow. All right.
But man, oh, man, I really love this movie. It's a lot of fun. You know, like I in my limited research, they had about the same budget as the first one. They tell more or less a completely different story, and they up the ante on a lot of stuff. Charlie and I talk about sort of the visual language that they took from the original, the stuff that they decided to enhance from the first one. And I think it's a very satisfying movie. As we this episode will drop before Halloween, so we're still technically in spooky season, as everyone likes to call it, or as I like to call it, all year. But
Halloween is a year-round thing for you, huh?
If you're still in the mood for a horror movie, I mean, like, horror movies are still good in on November the 3rd. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you could watch them. You can watch them on Christmas. That's what I do.
It's only a couple days after Dia de los Muertos.
But anyway, yeah, Charlie's great. We've had him on the show before. Can't wait to see what he does next. He's got a great eye. He talks a little bit also about they did that process that was, I believe, pioneered by Greg Fraser of finishing the film and doing a film out and then retransferring it. And he talks about why they did it and what it got them. And it's very interesting conversation.
Nice. That sounds awesome.
So, Ilya, what do we want to talk about as our close focus this week?
And now, close focus.
Oh, okay. So close focus. Big news in California. Gavin Newsom, our governor, more than doubled the state tax incentive.
What do you mean, our governor, guy who lives in Oregon? Anyway, go on.
Well, he just did something really amazing, which is to more than double the current state tax incentives. And by tax incentives, this is money that goes directly back to filmmakers and studios to help pay for the jobs that they create inside of California. So it went from $330 million to $750 million. It's a pretty big deal. That's they said they
did... or for everyone's scale, that's seven megalopolises. Well, like six. Go on.
But you know, look, the state is not in the business of 100% funding someone's movie, but they're
of course
in the business, or a television show. They're in the business, though, of making it much more attractive to work here, just as other states have been doing. Interesting, there's been a lot written about this, and they call the defecting productions that would otherwise go to California to other states or countries leakage, which I thought was kind of fun. I hadn't heard that, you know, it's a California production, it's leaking out somewhere else.
You might want to get a production diaper.
So here's an interesting statistic, though. They say that 71% of productions that have been rejected from the state tax incentives go somewhere else, ostensibly to receive the incentive. So they have a feeling that now, by more than doubling it, they should get a huge number of those productions back. We owe you know, a great deal of thanks to Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass. Karen Bass worked with Gavin Newsom to you know, implement this this new program. In fact, has a couple programs of her own as well. One of them are actually both of the two big ones I'm pretty excited about. She has a entertainment industry council now she's formed, and she's got sort of a who's who murderer's row of people who work in production and work in some sort of connection with the talent agents, the permit office, the,
oh, cool.
You know, lots and lots of different people, including someone from Netflix and from NBC Universal and entertainment unions. Like all these people are sort of joining together, which is cool. They're going to meet, I think, at least on a quarterly basis. She also has formed this other new initiative, which is going out as executive directive number 8. And it's the uplifting our economy through entertainment production. And she is establishing a film and television task force comprising of film liaisons from applicable city departments and external industry stakeholders to meet quarterly to address production-related challenges and solutions directly with departments. I'm assuming city departments. It says the office shall increase meeting frequency or call additional meetings as deemed necessary. And this is going to include liaisons from pretty much all the major, city functioning offices, like the Board of Public Works, including sanitation, engineering, contract administration, street lighting and street services, Office Whoa. Of Finance, City Planning, Fire Department, Police Department, Building and Safety, Cultural Affairs, Service Department, Parks and Recreation, Water and Power, Transportation, and the Library. So I assume that it's going to be about cutting through red tape and to make permitting and being able to make taking advantage of city facilities so much easier. And like, I don't think a lot of people knew this, but independent filmmakers in particular were able to take advantage of free locations by the city for quite a while. There's actually a whole list of locations that essentially you get.
I mean, it's deceptively free though, because there were always, obviously you'd have to have insurance, but then you would usually have to hire some kind of a site rep. So there was usually somebody who you'd have to pay. And if you're blocking traffic, you'd have to hire cops.
Not like that. I'm talking about like government buildings, like at the courthouse in Van Nuys. I knew a production there that got free run of like a building that would have more or less probably cost thousands and thousands of dollars for a location fee. And like interiors.
Yeah, and for like, people who aren't in LA, like if you're renting pretty much any location that's like more specific than like living room of a regular house or something, you're probably looking at, I would say, between $1,500 and $10,000 a day minimum, then usually a site rep, then also on top of that, usually some kind of giant insurance requirements, and it goes up and up. I mean, like I have a shoot coming up and no one batted an eye at $200 an hour for the location, plus a site rep.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of all normal. So getting a free location, especially something free that like has a look to it, that could be an interesting, that's more than what you could just like say to your friend, hey, can I shoot at your house or your apartment or something like that? That actually is kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And they've been doing that for years.
But it seems like this is all economically focused about getting people jobs. And if you're making a $100,000 movie, you're not going to be able to go IATSE. You might not be able to go SAG. Like you're going to have a crew of five people. It's not going to pump it economically. It doesn't have the same impact.
I'm going to disagree with you somewhat though, because like, there's plenty of indie productions that have, you know, let's say $500,000 to $1 million.
I just worked on one.
And they may not fit necessarily into the exact boxes that IATSE has. Like, you know, I know people who are doing like 2-month-long vertical projects, which totally count as production, but they don't fit inside of IATSE's neat box. It would be good to have someone who is...
Is it because IATSE's box is landscape and not portrait?
That's exactly what it is. Yes.
So, oh my God.
Yeah. And there are a lot of jobs from people who, they might be non-union, they might be non-traditional, but they're working in Los Angeles and money is being contributed to the economy. I would say that there's probably even more productions, more production days, which do not get permits, so they're not tracked, that have also been affected. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't get permits, but of course they should. But the film permitting office system could be friendlier and could have more advocacy and outreach to these people who wouldn't otherwise be getting permits. Like, it can be, if you're doing a 2-person, a 3-person shoot, which there's a ton of people these days doing stuff for social media that is like that, it doesn't really fall under the typical sort of like permit office stuff. And in fact, I will tell you that I see daily people going out and doing stuff that I'm sure don't have permits out in the city. I think it would make a lot of sense for the city to come up with a tiered permit system, get those people into the program, get those people official, and, you know, maybe have something like a site steward. Like if they had to hire like a site steward who might not necessarily be as expensive as a site rep, but someone who like is hired through the permit office, who pays, you know, pay a certain fee to, you pay that money and then you're legal, you don't get shut down, and you have access to certain spaces in the city. I feel like there's some really, really strong additional revenue that could be created by not turning a blind eye or to the productions who aren't typically the productions that people think of when they think of their giant, you know, movies and television shows. What say you, Ben? You think there should be another tier for these lowest end sort of like social media sort of creators who are out there doing pretty elaborate stuff and not getting permits?
I don't know. I mean, it's like if you're like so-and-so on the street doing your social media thing and you have like one of those little teeny tiny Best Buy special tripods with a ring light and your phone on it, I don't feel like you need to go get a permit to stand on Hollywood Boulevard and do your thing.
What about for the next level up, though? Like the crew of like five people, and they're out there with a real camera and a couple of real lights and they're doing a thing.
Oh, for sure. Because I've been that person and I've done it permitted and I've done it unpermitted. You know, I mean, like I stole a baseball diamond once.
Mm-hmm. Not in Beverly Hills. You'd be arrested.
No, it was in Sherman Oaks. Yeah. But it was like it was at Van Nuys Sherman Oaks Park years ago. And it's like it was a crew of like four or five of us. And I even brought out I had an old skate, you've probably seen my old skateboard dolly platform that runs on PVC pipe that I had, you know, 20 years ago. I still have it, but I haven't broken it out in a while. But, you know, like I took that out and it's like nobody cared. And I think that, you know, there is always that fear, and you'll hear the stories of people who like go out and steal a shoot, and they've got, because like once you've really invested in a crew and you have cast and you're paying people, you can't afford not to do that stuff, because if you get shut down, you got nothing and you wasted all your money. So it would be good if there was a more accessible way to do it that was safe and worked for a smaller tier filmmaker. I guess the question I keep circling back to, though, for the purposes of, you know, Mayor Bass's, you know, her cabal that she's creating to kind of figure out, cabal makes it sound nefarious. It's not nefarious. This round table, this bunch of people who are trying
You're
to help.
Calling Jason Reitman nefarious.
very nefarious. When you're talking about that kind of a thing, like, do those people move the needle at all in that kind of a world if you're going to create kind of this group that's going to help them? Now, the flip side is, like, you could say the same thing about, like, a movie like Tangerine, which started a very fruitful career that we're still seeing going, you know, and that was the most guerrilla of guerrilla shoots. I don't believe it was done with any permits. It was all shot on iPhones with lav mics and like a crew of two people. You know, would it have been better to permit that? Sure. You know, I don't know. I mean, there's always going to be that scrappy tier of filmmaker who's just going to not bother with that stuff. This is aimed at the fact that our industry is flailing in California right now. The industry in general is flailing. In California, there are thousands of professionals who work in the industry or who work in fields adjacent to the industry, dependent upon the industry. And I feel like they're feeling the pinch, because it's going to start to really influence, frankly, how people vote and how people, you know, and if people stay in California. We both know a ton of people, including yourself, who have vamoosed from California over the last few years for one reason or another. Obviously, you're still here all the time because you have a business here. But I know a lot of people who left, and like, you know, when we talked about this off mic beforehand, my biggest question was, well, how does this tax incentive compare to Georgia? And the truth is, Georgia's pumping more money into it. Like, Georgia's tax incentive is about twice what this is, and we can't compete with that, I don't think, or we're not going to. And, you know, the snarky thing I want to say is, like, finally we're going to get film production in the state of California, you know, like, but the truth is, how could they get Marvel to come back here? And not that, you know, that's the end all be all, but how could they get all that kind of work to come back?
Here's the thing, though, about Georgia's. Georgia's is a tax credit, which then has to go to a market. So let's say you produce a movie and your rebate is $1 million. chances are you're only going to get about 910,000 back. You don't get that full million because it goes into this market, and then various businesses which owe taxes to the state have to essentially bid on it. And, you know, the bidding starts low, and then eventually it usually works out about 90-91% is what I understand. So you lose some percentage of your tax incentive because you just don't get it from that market.
But in terms of like actual money that the state of Georgia is putting into it, it's significantly higher than what we're going to do in California.
It sounds like it's probably another 300 to 500 million more. So,
And that ain't nothing. And, you know, the thing is that...
but in California, if you're the filmmaker, you get a full refund. You get that full amount back. It's a refundable credit now. You don't have to go to a market. So if you get $1 million rebate, you're getting the full $1 million. You're not getting 900,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's all good, and I hope it helps. You know, the truth is, tax rebates will not make more television happen if the networks aren't ordering it and the streamers aren't ordering it, but. You know, it's still, I think, a huge step in the right direction. Hopefully it will, it'll spur more, you know, I mean, to me, I would be happy if I saw more mid-level features getting made. I'd rather see, you know, that many $20 million films versus, you know, $500 million films get made anyway. So,
yeah, you know, it's going to be interesting. It won't be boring. I know that there's going to be a lot of people talking about this for the weeks and months to come. And I think that you and I will have front row seats to actually see what actually is happening. And does this really move the needle for California? I have a suspicion that it will. I don't know how long it'll take to kick in, how quickly it'll move the needle. But boy, that I think that probably early 2025 is going to be an interesting time now.
Well, yeah. I mean, people have been saying alive till 25 as we kind of grit our teeth through this fiscal year. And I've even heard shit and bricks till 26. So hopefully
not that. Yeah, that seems extremely pessimistic.
I should give credit. It was Bill Totolo who said shit and bricks till 26.
Yeah, you know what? He told me that too, actually. So. All right. So, Ben, why don't we get to the interview?
All right. Well, here is Charlie Saroff.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
But well, thank you so much for coming back on the show, and congratulations on the runaway success. Like, you know, it was kind of horror film versus horror film at the box office. I don't know about the rest of the world, but in America, Terrifier 3 was number one, and then you guys came in and killed the clown.
Thanks for having me back, Ben. It's I'm really excited to see how people have responded to the film. And you never want to be in competition with other horror films. You want everyone to do well. And it looks like Terrifier has done really well, which is great. But
oh my god,
Fighting. Like I got to Australia before the release, and you know, there were a lot of billboards up here and everything like that. But it was a little bit of a shame to miss what was happening in LA. I think like a lot of friends were sort of reaching out and saying, "Dude, the city's covered in billboards and everything."
Oh, it was everywhere.
Did a good job with marketing again, but they did. It's exciting to see. Yeah.
And it's like I was talking to a friend of mine about this, and like it's been kind of an embarrassingly great year for horror movies. There have been so many great horror movies this year. There was The Substance, Long Legs. Late Night with the Devil, there've been so many strong ones, and I would put Smile 2 right up there on top with all of them. Like it's so good and surprising, you know, because like I don't know what your actual budget was, but the scuttlebutt I heard was that it was around the same budget, maybe a little more than the first one, and you guys really opened up the scope of it, and it feels I love the first one, as you know, but it feels really big, you know. I mean, like you have these giant concert scenes and stuff like that. Like really, it even starts with a bang. Like the whole opening sequence is just a great opening sequence. When you started talking about, you know, doing a sequel, and you're bringing the, you know, putting most of the same band back together to make the sequel, like what were the things where you're like. Because I remember like even the original movie wasn't originally called Smile. You like kind of found that. But this one is like really hanging on that motif. Yeah. Like what were the things that you were like, okay, we're going to keep this. What are the things you wanted to keep? What are the things you wanted to expand and push out on?
Yeah, sure. So Like Parker wanted, if he was going to come back and do a sequel, he's not the sort of guy that just wants to sidestep and get it done and move on. Yeah. You know, it's important. We're relatively early in our careers when it comes to making films, narrative, feature films. I mean, you want to be able to, you want to do a good job. You want to be able to elevate it, and we wanted to come out with a bang. And I think he, to his credit, he sort of came up with a really great idea to move it from the universe of the first film and cross the river into Manhattan and give it this whole new sort of world and a new take on the franchise. And but yeah, he really wanted to push it and elevate it. And you know, we didn't, you know, the things that did work about the first film, we wanted to keep. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel in a lot of ways, you know, in a lot of ways within the cinematography too, which I could talk about. But we definitely wanted to push it and go bigger. And you know, I think you mentioned things like the concert scenes and stuff like that. Like we wanted to do it in a credible manner. Like she's a pop star that's super famous that lives in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to skimp out on that. We can't just put her in a band room and make her some semi-famous. I mean, you could argue that you could create a great story out of any type of person doing anything. But in this case, Parker created a superstar, Sky Riley, and we really needed to show that. So, we wanted just to sort of step it up and go bigger. And you mentioned the opening scene. We wanted to be able to create
that opening scene was so great. And by the way, the first time I saw it, I know this isn't a cinematography thing, but it was in a Dolby theater that had the most thumping subwoofer ever.
Right. I love the Dolby experience.
Oh my god! It was like being hit in the head with a baseball bat every time there was a big bass thing. It was like jarring in the best possible way.
I love those cinemas. Like we did the Dolby Grade as well. And it's always so fun to feel how dark it is in there contrast and stuff you get. So I recommend people watch it there. They've got a really cool setup. And of course,
the audio. It's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. The everything, because I saw it, I told you off mic first, I did see it twice. And the other time I saw it at actually a really nice theater, but it was like, did not compare to the Dolby experience at all.
Yeah, it definitely makes a difference for sure. You really feel it. So yeah, that's great. But yeah, we just wanted to really make people, like, you know, a lot of people probably have gone to the sequel a little bit skeptical because a lot of sequels franchises, they come out and they do sidestep a little bit. We find not all the time, of course, but if, you know, not to compare it to a brilliant movie like Terminator 2, but we wanted to do a little bit, you know, make it stand on its own and like not just be like, okay, it was a continuation. Cool. It was all right. Or not as good as the first one or whatever. We wanted to give it a good shot at being something different and better and elevate it. Hopefully we did that. But yeah, seems like the response has been great. So that's cool. And just really happy with like the people love going to horror films. It's like really special to be a part of something that, you know, people go to the cinema for. All those other films you spoke of, like Long Legs and Late Night for the Devil and Terrifiers and everything. It's just, it's great that there are people showing up and it's a real cinema experience. Well, horror.
I think that's one of the things that people really like, comedies, and comedy isn't really having its moment right now, unfortunately, but comedies and horror movies are better in a crowd, you know, and going to see your movie. And then like, it's just like hearing the screams or the vocalizations or looking around. Cause you know, your movie gets pretty gnarly, pretty much right out of the gate, and it's got some just amazing shocking moments, but let's talk about
this one too, right? It gets more laughs, maybe nervous laughter, but there's deliberately some, I think, like, yeah, Parker kind of made it a little bit more absurd, and there's definitely some more comedic
so beats. I noticed some motifs in this that I didn't notice in the first one, and maybe if I went back and rewatched the first one, I haven't seen it in a couple of years, maybe I would notice those too. But there were a lot of camera inversions, upside down camera shots. There were a lot of shots into mirrors, which are always interesting because I don't know, just the way my mind works. I'm like, did they have to paint themselves out, or are they just being clever about where they put the camera? You know, and also there were a lot of like live performance sequences, not a lot, but maybe like two or three, where you have like pretty hardcore stage lighting, like lighting design, like you would have for a Lady Gaga sized concert.
That get me up.
Did it? Well, let's start with that actually, because to me, like I've done a lot of theater work, and so I don't pretend to know anything about theater lighting, but like I understand that some of the difference between the two, and like, you know, kind of high, very like kind of, I don't even know what you'd call it, like fashion-y, glamoury. that kind of stuff. So how did, did you approach, did you design that? Did you work with a lighting designer on that stuff? Like someone who does stage stuff? Like how did you go about creating the looks for that, that kind of stuff?
So like very early on, like when Parker sort of wrote the scene in and we knew that we had to sort of go big, we wanted to create a proper show. You know, we didn't want to skimp out on it or sort of go into a smaller band room and just VFX the whole thing. We really wanted to feel credible. So it first started like discussions with Parker, the production designer, Lester Cohen, Alexis Forte, the costume designer. And I we'd sort of work on the different show elements. There's like two main scenes that have taken place on that scene. One is a rehearsal, one is the finale. And we all worked closely on like the color palette and the color of the lights. And, you know, obviously the choreography is a massive part of it as well, which came in. And we all got on the same page, but like, as far as I go, I'm concerned, like I had to, I'm not like the language of theatrical stage lighting is a bit different to feature film lighting and film work. The lighting sources are different. They're all called different names. Like I know the basics. I know where the light should sort of come from and what it should do and what it should feel. But you're right. I brought on a amazing lighting designer, Brian Spett, who does a lot of live shows and performances. So he came in and sort of helped with like designing the rig and knowing where things should go. You know, if I was like, I think there should be movers out in the audience and you know, to create these sort of like, you know, droney kind of, just moving lights and stuff like that. And he would be able to be like, oh, that's that type of light. Maybe they go there. And it's like, thank you. Because it's different to me going, hey, you know, I needed like a vortex there with a, you know, double breaks through some diffusion frame or whatever. It's a bit, it's a different language. So a lot of it was more like working with him and explaining, this is the look we want. How do we achieve it? And he obviously is like, I'd love to collaborate with people. I think the best, something important about being a cinematographer is like surrounding yourself with great people that know, you know, bringing on a great gaffer, a great grip, in this case, a great lighting designer that does theatrical shows and stuff like that and stage lighting. So yes, like all of the above, like we worked with professionals in that space. Like a lot, you know, we brought in, we shot that scene, those scenes in Albany in upstate New York. We were able to book out their arena there, MVP Arena. And it was amazing to see how quick they turn those places over. It's a bit like in a place like Los Angeles or New York with Madison Square Garden. Like it'll be a hockey game one night, then the NBA, then a live concert. There was a, I forget the artist's name, but there was a live concert there before we had to bump in. And that night they took it all down and they brought in the stage and they worked so quickly. So that was an amazing experience working with all those people and when designing the stage and the lighting and seeing how they go about it. We had a massive time crunch there. We only occupied the space for about 5 days and that was including bump in, bump out. So we're only able to shoot on that stage for, you know, a few days. But when we, with all the stuff that we had to do, it was a real tight squeeze. So, you know, working with those people is incredible, just seeing how they operate because they're used to having to turn something around so quickly. But yeah, and then from there, like we didn't obviously have a audience of 15,000 people. We worked really closely with an amazing VFX house called Rodeo, based out of Montreal. Robert Brock is the VFX coordinator, and we worked really closely with him on how to sort of plate the audience in a really natural way. And, you know, we would move 500 extras around the arena, and a lot of VFX did go into it, but the actual space is real. And the people you are seeing are real too. It's just been, you know.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because especially the second time I saw it, I was like looking at that because it's like there's sort of a wave of people kind of around the stage and then it gets a little hazier, you know, like it would, the atmospheric perspective or whatever. And there's lights kind of blaring in. But also I was wondering, like, I wonder how much they filled it. Like it's hard to look at that and not think about the M. Night Shyamalan movie Trap. Where,
yeah, we haven't seen yet, but I need to watch. It's something in the zeitgeist with pop stars at the moment.
Yeah. You know, like, there's a lot of overlap there. And like, I think they really did fill a space because a lot of the action takes place in the audience or him like waiting through crowds. So even if they didn't fill it completely, there were a lot of extras going on in that. But it's a different vibe because you don't ever like really go off the stage. We're always on the stage with her.
We were very clear about the perspectives we needed to help save time, but also help with things like VFX and extras. Like we tried to wrangle as many as we could in Albany and a lot did show up. But yeah, what you do see is they're real extras, but the way they kind of do it is jumble it around and they with the plating and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
If you look really closely, which you probably will never be able to see because of the way they do it, like you might see the same person three times, four, no, a lot more. Like the same person could spread out like 100 times. But
when they're like just a dot in the distance, you'd never ever know.
Yeah. If anything is too obvious, we can go in the color grade and change the color of the sign. Or there was a massive process of like, you know, people just scouring the audience to make sure that people are moving properly.
Oh, really?
Too close to one another. Like they're basically their clones weren't too close to one another and things like that. But a huge chunk, like the very finale, like the final shot where we're looking out to the audience, the final shot of the audience, I should say, most of those people, that's basically a full, you know, audience shot because we're a bit tired and stuff like
yeah.
that. But so yeah, it was a bit of a process, but it was an amazing, rewarding experience. I'm really happy how they all came up. And, you know, people like Dave Cole, our colorist, really brought those scenes to life as well. What he was able to do, particularly with the rehearsal scene, the one that's sort of in red and blue, and mm-hmm. I was so impressed.
It's gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. Yeah.
He brought a little trick in from the Batman that he sort of learned. It was a bit of a rule-breaking thing he kept saying, but it works. And I was just like, the way it really popped the red, it still keeps the red within a safe zone, but it's just so rich. And I was really impressed with that. So another thing we did with the concert scenes, and in a lot of scenes in general, we want things to bloom a bit more than the first film, like highlights and the stage lighting. But, you know, her wardrobe, she wears a lot of sparkly kind of amazing costumes that Alexis put together, and we wanted that to really, you know, so I used like similar filtration of the first film, like, you know, low cons, and then sometimes we would shoot, like, depending on the shot, like, you know, wide open and on old lenses kind of gives you this bloomy feel, like the photography scene, everything sort of just blooms out, almost overexposed, but not clipping. You don't want that clipping kind of feel. We printed to film again and scanned back.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we a little bit of a different process this time. We went to the same intermediate stock, but we skip bleached the process, and it.
Oh, really?
Essentially, like the color science that Photochem are working with will, you know, you think of films with a skip bleach are like, you know, Seven and
of course,
very very contrasty, very desaturated. We didn't really go down that route, and it's more what it did to the highlights. And
oh, really?
That's what I was sort of trying to get back to. Like, I had to sort of ask the question a bunch of times myself. I'm like, well, why not just come out like really desaturated, which is a look that I love, but it wasn't right for Smile 2. But instead, it sort of borrowed an element of that, and which was these bloomy highlights. So when we looked at the before and after of just being digital, just going to the intermediate stock that we went to last time, and then that plus the skip bleach, the lights on the stage and her wardrobe and just things like that, which is sort of really like the halation is something we really, really like. So we went for that. And again, it's not just to make it look like film. It's just another way of creating a new look. Like I think of it as just borrowing some of that technology, making a sandwich and trying to find something unique to the particular that works for the film. And I think, you know, there's a bit of textures there. There's a bit of gate weave. Like if you know, all these things that subconsciously you're kind of used to when watching a film shot on film, a little bit of that is there. But, you know, it's still very much, you know, we shot on the Alexa 65 again. It's like for its field of view and all that sort of stuff. And I think it just borrows a lot from all of the technology and, you know, makes a soup out of it. And when something right, it's like, yeah, that's like we worked a lot of different tests, and if something felt right, we went for it. But it wasn't about sort of just trying to, you know, it wasn't about just trying to make it look like film, but we wanted to borrow elements of that.
Well, let me ask you something that's a little maybe technical. I'm interested to hear the answer. So you're filming it, and you know you're going to do this film out and bring it back in technique. So does that change the way you light it or shoot it at all? Are you like, okay, well, we need to make sure that our highlights end here, or are you just shooting it the way you would if you were going to do a digital finish and then running it through that for the extra secret sauce that it brings you?
Sure. I would just shoot it normally, to be honest, because of the different control that you have in post, especially with Photochem and the way Dave will operate with it is like, it's not like a one size fits all kind of approach. Like you would shoot it normally. Obviously you always want to make sure you're in a good place with exposure, and it's the, you know, I'd still use the filters and all the things that I would want to use, but when it goes out to film and then comes back, we bring it back into the color suite and balance things. And, you know,
I was going to ask that too. Like, do you grade it? So you're grading it twice in a way.
Essentially. Yeah. You're giving it a bit of a look over. The second pass is obviously a lot, you know, quicker, and you kind of, and you don't have to, again, it's not a one size fits all approach. Like if if you're on a time crunch and maybe it's a lower budget film that's, you know, really small, you want to try and make it work, you can just shoot, go to film, come back. It'll need to be dust busted and cleaned. Otherwise, you know, it'll probably have a lot of little white speckles all over it and stuff like that, which some productions have opted to keep depending on what they want. And there's like different stages to it. If you want to just go for it and come back in, it's probably going to look great. And it's a little bit like shooting on film where it's always an element of surprise. In the case of Smile 2, it came back into the color suite. And if something needed a little bit more of a balance or a look at, we did it. But it was minimal. It doesn't really shift it around that much. Like it's not like it dramatically affects exposure or completely mushes up the image. It's quite subtle.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, and I feel like, you know, we're early days for that process. Like really the only people we've talked to who do it are you and Greg Fraser. I'm sure that there's plenty of people doing it though.
I really like it. I mean, you know, hearing my name next to him is always just like, oh, syndrome. But we share a colorist, so I'm just really grateful that he had all that experience, and Photochem has that like thing set up there. I mean, they're obviously a color, you know, it's a post house with does color and other things, but they have the film lab as well, so they're very clued in on that technology and what they can do. They have those facilities, so. When we did the first film and we found out it was going theatrical and we were working with Dave, it became a possibility. So I'm just lucky all of that worked out. You know, we're in the right place at the right time with the right people that were in Paramount were open to it. And we went for it again on the second one.
I would almost love to see a side by side of, you know, Smile or Smile 2, you know, even just a couple of frames of, you know, here's the digital output. Here's after we ran it through the film out process.
It's a lot cleaner. And I think, all right, for example, Sky's apartment, we shot that on a stage in upstate New York in Newburgh, set in the Woolworth building in downtown Manhattan. The backdrops that we look at out the windows are LED walls and they work quite well. Like
they looked amazing. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm looking at stuff like that, I'm like, is that a translight? And then it's like, no, everything's moving. That's definitely not a translight.
Yeah, it makes a big difference for sure. Just having light out there, you know, the atmosphere of the city causes that little twinkly bokeh that you kind of get, and like it makes a difference. So
no, it sells.
We went for them, and you add the film scan to it. It another step happens where it just molds into the curtains a bit more. It just sort of, I don't know, infuses into the image that little bit more. Like, you know, I think it can help VFX and makeup and all these things, even though everyone did a brilliant job, like, you know, Sasha's work with the makeup and everything was amazing, but you add the celluloid to it, it just sort of smooths things out a bit. I think it helps marry in all those old elements. You know, it still doesn't lose its clarity. It's still a sharp image, but when you look at the before and after, that was really interesting to see. And we didn't want it to be like super grainy or anything. There's definitely more texture in it now, but the Alexa 65 is such a clean camera with it would be weird to sort of be like, hey, we were on this large clean sensor, but it looks like 16 mil. That was going far, but it was other things that were really important.
Again, since the success of the original Smile, which like, again, you guys didn't know that it was even going to be called Smile when you were making it, and sort of, I'm assuming that between the way it was marketed and the things the audience responded to, like, were there specific motifs about it that you leaned into maybe a little more? You're like, oh yeah, that idea, which we were trying out, thought it was kind of cool, but that worked way better than we thought it did, and kind of went further with it on this one. Like, what were some of those kind of motifs and techniques or whatever?
Yeah, sure. I think you mentioned reflections earlier. They were definitely prominent in the first film to a degree, but you know, the idea behind that is that Sky can't escape herself. You know, she's always in the spotlight. She's always on stage. She's always being watched, looked at. Fans are always harassing her. As she's unraveling, we really wanted to make that even more intense and just so lots of mirrors, lots of reflections. That was one of the motifs, like the mirrored hallway, her bathroom, huge, you know, breaking glass, and just constantly being, just not being able to escape herself, I guess. Yeah. That came with some trickery and it was difficult. Like, we're definitely having to put the camera in places to hide it. But as you said, like, there's some certain instances where it's just obvious that we had to paint a reflection out. So we would lean on VFX to help with that. But it's definitely one of the motifs. Like the upside down shots you mentioned, there's probably a few more of them. It's just, we found that effective in just really making people uncomfortable and you know, it's just, you know, her world's turning upside down. It's quite
especially
literal,
like the upside down drone shots. Like, I don't know what it is about an upside down drone shot that's just discomforting.
It was cool shooting, and obviously, you know, being from Australia, I do live in LA, but I'd love New York City. It's like a fun, it's just an amazing place. I've always wanted to do it in Manhattan. We shot, we did spend some time in the city, all the exteriors, most of the exteriors, and, you know, the drone unit, and we mopped up some things on a stage there and stuff like that. But it's a great place to shoot, and just being up in one of those buildings and kind of like looking out at the city, and it was a special time. I feel like it can be very lonely up there too. We wanted to get that across, the loneliness of being someone that's really famous, but, you know, she's shutting out a lot of her family and friends, and you know, having her in this apartment, up in this building with just like a sea of skyscrapers out there. I don't know, kind of, even though you're surrounded by millions of people, we wanted to sort of get that point of loneliness across. There's some of the things. Like we lensed in quite a similar way. The camera moves in quite a similar way. Like we wanted to kind of, you know, not reinvent the wheel and that stuff. And I think Parker did a great job with crafting, you know, some scenes that really make you uncomfortable. And it was just, you know, we probably went about it in a similar way, but, like, you know, we were given a little bit more to play with. I think the world's a lot more expensive now since the first film. So it wasn't like we had a ton, but, like, I think everyone really hustled to sort of help make it elevated and bigger than the first, and we certainly, you know, had some more resources, which was exciting. So that was that was fun to play with. But you know, there's never enough time, money, or, you know, that sort of stuff. It's always a time crunch.
Doesn't matter what you're doing.
Well, we can't afford that, so you got to look this way instead. I think it probably never changes, but you know, I'm grateful that we did definitely have some more resources to play with. So,
is there a specific lens that you have found to shoot the smile, because the people smiling in this is maximum creepy. Is there a specific lens that you use, or is it mostly just like you're in the scene? And this leads me to my hackiest question that I've asked anyone in a long time, but it's like, you've got Jack Nicholson's son in the movie in a shot that looks like a Kubrick shot with him smiling. Was that a reference at all?
Look, when you see him smile and you think of the shot, like it certainly was exciting.
Yeah.
Who doesn't love The Shining? And I know it's one of Parker's favorite films, and it's one of my favorite films. Like, it's brilliant. And, you know, Ray, like, did an amazing job taping for the show. He wasn't we have to get him for that reason at all. Like, I know Parker looked at a lot of different actors and he absolutely smashed it. And I hope he just becomes, like, you know, a prominent actor in his own right. And he already is, but, like, it wasn't necessarily like, hey, let's set it up like The Shining at all, but we couldn't help, like, when we'd see him, and then I've already seen the memes get out there comparing him to his dad, like he's resemblance, it's there, and it was a joy to see. But it wasn't necessarily like, well, not at all like, oh, hey, we have to set this up like,
I mean you would never do that. That's manipulative of too many things, but I'm probably where you are, where it's like, you're there, you're setting that shot up, and you can't not think of The Shining in that moment.
Yeah, it happened. But to answer your question about lensing, they're different across the board a little bit. Usually always a wide lens. Mm-hmm. You know, we could be on the 28 or 35 or the 45. We shot on the RE-DNAs, and, you know, that's on the Alexa 65. So it's like a very large, very wide lenses when you compare to, like, Super 35. But, for example, the little girl, like, in order to really get that across as being, like, super creepy when she came up close to Skye at the photo, you know, at the signing and the photo shoot, that was on a 28, and we just found that, you know, being in that close on that lens just makes people super uncomfortable. But generally, what the wide lenses, it'd be one of those three. There isn't really a one size fits all for the smile. It's whatever kind of gets the creepiness over in that moment, but we don't go long on it. Like, we never really use our long lenses. So the Ray Nicholson smile, like, yeah, that's probably on like a 35 and things like that. When we cut back to Naomi, like, and I'd love that shot where she's like, stop smiling at me. Like, excuse me, my voice is a bit gone. I had a bit of a cold last week, but that was probably on a 28. Like, I think just, like, really allows you to get up close and personal. And
what about just like the lens height or something like what is the anatomy of the smile shot when you're like, okay, I know it needs to be like this and this and this. And like, is it just an intuitive thing, or do you sort of in your mind have like a recipe of like pretty wide lens, pretty close up, above or below the eye line? Like, what's the secret sauce?
Again, you know, it's perspective. I'll use the example of our brilliant young lady that was at the photo shoot. You know, like, she's obviously a lot smaller, so we're not afraid, like, more top down on her. And but generally, like, Parker has a recipe for how they should stand and act with the smile, essentially. Like, you know, it's slightly chin down, it's very symmetrical, it's very flat to camera. We don't like to come at it like kind of on an angle when we can help it. It's more their posture. Wide lenses, it's generally probably just under eye line level, like, but again, you know, it just, you know, there's different approaches depending on which character it is that's smiling. But it's a funny one. I don't know, a lot of it's on a subconscious level too, like when we're, you know, I think Parker's great with that too. If it's something's not quite right, it'll be like, come up a little higher, come a little down, you know, we kind of figure it out depending on the character. So.
And the other thing, and I noticed this is a motif that kind of carried over from the first one, was the kind of pervasive use of zooms. And kind of refresh my memory, like, what is it when, because like, it feels like zooms are reserved for very specific moments, usually with our character by herself.
Say emotionally transitional moments when something really heavy's gone down. She's, you know, really going to the next stage of like her unraveling. Or it could just be to hone in on something as well. But I, you know, one of the first thing that comes to mind is at Lucas's apartment, like, you know, played by Lucas Cage, like when, you know, I don't think there's really a spoiler at this point, but when he hammers himself with the weight. Oof. And
brutal scene.
Of that, you know, that's obviously a huge turning point because she witnesses the first suicide and the curse is handed over. So that's an example of where Zoom felt correct. And I'd say that's kind of why. And, you know, there's sort of an old feel. We borrow a lot from old movies and, you know, try to, and new, and it's just a, you know, whatever kind of feels right approach, but there's something nostalgic about a Zoom, which we like as well. So.
Well, I feel like Zooms have kind of come back. I mean, they kind of come and go in terms of popularity, Zoom as a move. And I forget who it was.
Feel a bit like they were talked down a bit for a while when I was first starting out and like, film school, and even some of the lecturers or people would be like, you know, you should always move. If you should not, don't use a Zoom, like track in and move. Like, there's a, now I realize like, it's just, everything's on the table. Like, whatever feels right. You've got all these tools. There shouldn't be rules like that. Maybe, you know, some rules that you're meant to learn and then break, but it does feel like they're coming back, and why not? Like, they've been back for a while, but you know what I mean? Like, I do think they were a bit of a dirty thing for a while. I don't know why, but yeah.
I was talking to, I'm blanking on her name, but she was on the show. It might've been Sybil Barton, but I don't know if it was her. And she had done something that used a lot of Zooms and dollies. And I was like, what makes you choose one versus the other? And what she said to me, and this has really stuck with me, is that like, dolly brings the camera closer to the actor, but Zoom brings the actor closer to the audience.
That's it's a much more intellectual way of being able to, I'll steal that quote and give it to Nathan. No, it's so true. Exactly. Like, they have a different, they provoke a different emotion for sure. And I guess that is a great, like, that way to explain why we zoomed into Sky after. Yeah, during the aftermath, it's bringing her closer to the curse. It's bringing her closer to
that world.
You know what I mean? Like, so that's why it feels right. You know, I think just, again, on a subconscious level, like, I think like we go into things and even during rehearsal and stuff is like what feels right. And but that's a great way to explain it. I'll have to remember that. So
feel free. I hope it was Sybil Martin. If it wasn't, I apologize to whoever it was who said it to me, but, for misattribution, but yeah, I mean, to me, it's something that I always think about, like, you know, because in a modern movie, you know, how many different ways do you have to move the camera? You've got gimbal or Steadicam or slider or jib arm or, you know, what drone. There's a million ways to do it. So choosing a zoom is like, that's a choice now. Whereas I feel like, you know, go back to the Nicholas Rogue days of the 1970s, and it was like, oh, it'll be faster, you know.
Yeah. It's so amazing when you go back and watch films. Like, I watched 12 Angry Men again recently. Mm. It's mainly set in one room, but the way the camera moves around and you don't get bored, you know, it like watching, I'm just so in awe of how they used to move the camera back in the day, you know, like when you think about like the Tarkovsky thing, films and like the, you know, the famous, is it I Am Cuba? And like the amount of
Oh my
time,
God, that
effort
shot
that
is
sort of gone
freaking
into those
amazing.
two. I know. And I feel like some of that is lost and it sort of feeds into the whole economics of how we have to work so quickly now. And, you know, because we can move the camera with all these different tools, it just feeds into go, go, go. And it would have been such an interesting time to make films like before all this technology was around and you had to really think outside the square
Yeah,
to kind
where no matter what you did, the
of.
camera was, you know, like a 25-pound brick that had to be handled
Exactly.
with
It's not
extreme
film.
care.
There's no monitors to watch it. And like
Yeah.
I'm just so in awe of that stuff, you know? Like it's still difficult now. So I can only imagine what it would have been like back then. And
That I Am Cuba shot, I mean, like I feel like you watched, like I watched that, and it's mind-boggling, but also even going back to like Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin, some of the innovative stuff that those guys did before nobody really even understood what the camera was, you
It's
know.
so special. Like, yeah, it's cool to go back and watch that stuff. But like one thing I noticed about 12 Angry Men is like everything, it's wobbly and stuff, but it doesn't matter. Like it's kind of cool. Like these tracking shots that come over the table
Yeah.
in the room. And you know, you can see it shake. It's not perfect, but now, like, if you know, there's a bit of a shake in these sorts of moves, everyone's like, you know, you gotta, I don't know, probably even myself at times too, but like, this is the imperfections where it's sort of interesting to see that. And, anyway.
What I love about a movie like that too, is that you can basically shoot an entire movie in one room and it doesn't feel like it was block shot. It feels like it's using the room to tell the story. The room's a character.
So why I'm bringing it up, I'm just so impressed that you don't get sort of bored. Like it's a brilliant script, but I think the way it's shot is like really holds you in it for sure. Like it does its job. It does what it's meant to do, that's for sure.
Well, cool. Are there any, I'm sure you've been doing a lot of press about this. Are there any questions or anything that what are the things that you're the proudest of about Smile 2 that like no one's talking about? The things that the kind of the hidden gems that if we knew it would blow our minds.
Good question. Like I'm sort of proud of all of it. Like it was a, you know, like I think again, Parker did a great job in wanting to really elevate things and not just sidestep. So there was never a dull moment. Lots to figure out. Every scene had its challenges from the opener right through to the ending. Like they all had their challenges. It wasn't really a scene that would go by where you were like, oh damn, that was kind of easy. That was like a, not that I want that at all, but it wasn't, we'd just laugh about it. Like people that I work closely with, like Dan Shanoff, the ACAM operator, does such a brilliant job. And like we would just look at each other and be like, yeah, none of these are really straightforward, are they? And it's like a good thing, but it's not like, okay, next scene we get a bit of reprieve. It was just always like, there's a challenge with how we move the camera, how we would block, how it'd light. I'm kind of proud of the opening Wana. Like that was a really
Oh my
difficult
God. Now,
trailer.
so was that how much of that was one or how much of that was
Pretty much all the
seamless
way
edits?
through to Kyle coming out the window. Obviously, we had to stitch that because the beginning, you know, we saw a car, like the car that we used, like Parker really wanted a wide lens right in close to Kyle at the beginning. Then he wanted to pull out through the window, which was replaced with VFX, but that was one shot, you know, pan around, come back. We were on a dolly for that. But then it was like we unclipped to handheld. And then it was a oneer all the way through to the stitch where we came out the window and then we'd have to change. We went to
So
like
all of that
a
was that. I mean, that's an impressive because, like, you know, we see a lot of movies with apparent oneers, but you know, like there's
But they're
a whip pan or whatever where you can hide a
on the
cut.
whip and like there I think there might have been a stitch there for performance, but when we shot it was as a oneer. We did not have any breaks. And I'm not trying to like say, hey, it's a oneer over this and that. I just don't know. I know there was a stitch definitely coming out the window. But when we went, maybe went around to Lucas or something for there was like a performance thing or something, they may have found a way. But when we did the print take on the day, we just followed it all the way through and we were really
Wow.
impressed.
Well, and
Like
that
three.
one coming out the window comes out and then ends up going up. So it's
Yes. So that was broken again. So it's like three shots essentially, and plus a VFX plate or something like that. So yeah, we went to the buggy, you know, that essentially gets mulled over with like a what the football players would use with like a, but it was like a green pad, you know, like we'd come. Stunt coordinator come and sort of smash him onto a mattress, and then that would be
Spoiler alert for those listening, like Kyle Gallner gets run over by a truck like in the opening scene,
shit.
and it's pretty gnarly.
Yeah, and then we went to a crane, but that was like there was a cutting point within that because we needed plate and stuff like
It
that.
was a
But all
crane and not a drone. It was an actual crane
that was a crane,
because it goes up
maybe
really high. Because I
five
mean,
footer or
like
something. Yeah.
you're basically showing, shall we say, the logo,
Yeah.
the central image of
quite
the movie.
absurd in a great way. I think a lot more blood and guts than maybe you've written, but it was just a cool way to bring in the title for sure.
Oh, so cool.
But yeah, we're really proud of that, and that was tough too because it was lit like on the we rehearsed for a day where we didn't shoot anything, where all the team like would get there, this. It was a big dance. Like that house, I think, was a great location for a lot of reasons, but it was still quite tight in there.
Yeah.
But we had SFX crew up in the ceiling on the beams, like firing the squibs off. We would, our boom opera would be dancing around and trying to stay out of shot. And
were you operating or were you?
No, that was Dan. I'm going to give him credit for that. It's, I love to operate, but like that was him. And that's the Alexa 65 on his shoulder. Amazing job up and down stairs. We probably did, at least not some of them weren't full takes. So Parker would know to cut kind of early if something wasn't working right, because there's not really any point in going forward if a squib didn't go off or someone was in shot or a camera. There's obviously things go wrong in a shot like that, so he would just call cut early if we didn't think we were going to get it.
Yeah.
But those the takes that we went all the way through, it was like, yeah, it's a tough job. And it was, and yeah, we rehearsed a day and it was snowing, like it was really cold. You can obviously see the snow on the ground, but on the rehearsal day, it was like buckling down, and we're just like, oh God, this is, it was our first day of shooting.
Oh,
was
wow.
So we got thrown in it. We had to do things like cut the front of that car off that Kyle's in, because, to get the camera in that close with a rig to be able to slide back and it's a budgetary thing too. Like maybe there's another way of doing that with a, crane that can kind of scope out and stuff, but we only had that for one day for the finale, for when, he gets hit and things like that. So we had to sort of think outside the square of how to, go from being on a dolly to unclip to handheld to then work very closely with the VFX to find that stitch point when he comes out the window and things like that. So yeah, it was a tricky one. And obviously the sun, it was a cloudy day, fortunately, which helps with a shot like that, because then you don't have to change exposure as much, but there's obviously a large iris pool and in outside and in. And fortunately the print take was quite late in the day as it's getting a little bit darker. So, some of the early takes, there's like a massive iris pool and you kind of notice it. And I was a little bit like, oh God, is this going to play as well? Is it going to be too obvious? Like you can get away with a bit. Everyone sort of expected to see that. But like, I feel like we were able to hide some of the challenges within the action. So the technical challenges within the action. And, I think Kyle does such a cool job in that. And yeah, I don't know. That was a fun. I'm proud of that. But like across the board, like, I just think we brought most of the same crew back and everyone rallied and it was exciting. I don't know. It was a fun shoot.
And there was another scene that like really jumped out at me too, was the argument scene in the car that is a flashback way later. But you talk about how you chose to cover it, because it's kind of unconventional for that kind of a scene.
Sure. So again, Parker comes to me and he's like, look, we're not cutting. We're not breaking that shot. Like it has to feel like one take. Again, there might've been a performance cut or some reason to go in the A-frame of the vehicle when it's panning back and forth, but we certainly shot it like in a way where we didn't cut, and it was a challenge. He wanted that right, like the camera right in between them on a wide lens, and like it's a little sports car, so having to find a solution for that was a little bit of a journey. But we got there. We actually used the Sony Rialto for that shot. That was but basically you take the sensor off the Venice. They used that camera in the cockpit of the fighter jets in Top Gun and things like that.
Oh, wow.
So it's really brilliant camera, but you can just basically take the sensor off. So you've got like a little brain and you put the lens on and then you feed the cable to the recorder. So that really helped. But we basically cut the car in half. We cut the ceiling out. We put an electric slider at the top that was remotely operated. And yeah, we just had the camera sitting them on a remote head, and it would just pan back and forwards between them. And then, the camera pulled back as they went off the cliff. But that was all done on a stage against blue screen. We couldn't use the LED walls as such for backgrounds for those because of the way the camera moved. We weren't really in a volume. We just had to set it up kind of. But what we did do is use LEDs out of shot for interactive light. So we shot the plate for that, the mountain road, on an array of cameras that would, that like a 9-camera array would drive up that road. We were there on a cold Saturday night when it was sort of snowing and stuff like that, but it was fun. And then the going off the cliff, we used a drone for that. So we drove up that road and got our plate shots, and then a drone would take over to fly off the cliff. So we literally flew a drone down into some trees, and I think the take that they used, it literally just recovered The operator was like, whoa, like, because I think it's the way up to get clipped a tree. And so he got very close, so which was great for the shot, because we wanted to feel like they were actually going straight in. But yeah, so it was a whole different bunch of plates, and you know, I put a bunch of like puck lights on that car to try and get a little bit of brake light on the mountain wall and the railing and stuff on the side of the road. And what else did we do? We replaced the car headlights with brighter lights, to match the drone. So when we did do the drone shot, we had a light on the drone, and in order to match temperature and how it looked, we took that light off and you know, put it on as basically uses as car headlights. And it was a big puzzle, but it was a fun one. So hopefully it all worked out, because there was lots of different and VFX like helped me out massively in that, like the way they seamlessly put, you know, marry the plates in and help like sort of push the lighting in certain ways, you know, like emphasize the red or emphasize, yeah. Like, you know, when we were shooting it and panning back and forwards, like we would have like a car headlight that would kind of fade up and down on them. And they did such a great job in sort of marrying in when cars were passing and emphasizing that and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it was a big collaboration.
Thank you for coming on here. For people who are looking to see more of your work or interact with you online or whatever, is there Instagram or a website or any place that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm on Instagram. It's just my name. You can find me easily if someone... I'm always trying to reach out. Like, sometimes I get a lot of questions from filmmakers or film students, and I do my best to respond if anyone has a question. Like, I feel like I'm... You always have imposter syndrome with this stuff. I feel like I'm kind of early in it all and learning so much along the way. But if there is anything I can...
I think you can move past the imposter syndrome. I mean, yeah, like...
I don't think it'll ever go away. Like, I remember reading a... interview with Roger Deakins, and he was sort of saying that like every film he'll be in the director's viewfinder, like looking through going, I hope this works, like it. So gave me a lot of faith. And
well, it's probably good for people to hear that, though, because I mean, it's like, you know, I think of you as outrageously accomplished. And I think that, you know, everybody has that feeling, but also and correct me if I'm wrong, but like, when I'll have that feeling up until the moment I'm on set. And then when I'm on set, I can't think about it because I'm focused on the job at hand.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think like after day one, you just sink into it, and then you go into adrenaline mode, and it's just it's a war that you just have to keep fighting. And yeah, you're right. Like, and there's definitely times it's not constant. It's just, you know, it's actually a healthy thing, because then it makes you step up to the plate. You go into things just like, sometimes I'd worry that maybe is it going to be mediocre or something. You always got to challenge. I think you have to be uncomfortable. So.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, like, yeah, it keeps you humble, but I mean, like, it's got to be a good feeling to know that you shot the number one movie in the world. Like,
crazy. No, I'm stoked that people are responding to it. Most of the reviews are good. Really happy for Parker and the crew and everybody involved. Like Naomi, of course. Like,
yeah, great cast.
It. Absolutely smashed it in every scene. Just. Yeah, unraveling from scene to scene and just giving it her all. Like, she's so talented. She sings, she dances. All the recordings are her. It's her voice.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the show, man. It's great really to see you. And hopefully I'll see you before Smile 3, but maybe for Smile 3 as well. You know, we'll whatever you got coming up next.
See what happens there. I'm not sure. But, like, yeah, it will be a Smile 3, whether Parker wants to do it. It's, you know, TBD. I know he's got some other great things on the go, and, you know, I will see, you know, if he goes there and he wants me there, I'll do it. But if not, you know, I don't know. It's good to, I like the idea of doing something fresh as well and something new. And there are a few things. So, you know, whatever. Yeah. I've learned to not really just to go with the flow, because you never know what's around the corner. So
great. Great. Well, thanks for coming back on.
Hey Ben, guess what time it is?
What time is it?
Ooh, sorry, you're getting into the ASMR
spooky
right there.
Season.
It is time to pay the bills. We have to thank our fine friends over at Airy. Airy Maker.
That's scary.
Scary Airy. During October, it's Scary Airy.
Sorry. I don't know why Halloween became the official holiday of mediocre puns. Go on.
Airy has come out with a new set of lenses, and actually a really cool set of lenses. Some of my team went to go take a look at them recently, and they are smaller and more affordable compared to the Signature Primes, which are big, incredible, beautiful lenses. Probably my favorite professional cinema lenses on the market that you can buy today. They're really incredible lenses, but they have a less expensive, more stylized set of lenses called Enso. And they're actually named after the, inspired by the circular Zen symbol in Zen calligraphy, which is sort of, you've probably seen, which is looks like a brush stroke and like almost a perfect circle. So they have a really beautiful look, and they have interchangeable rear elements that can affect the style of the image, which is super cool. I like them that they're small. Their LPL mount, which I really firmly believe is the cinema lens mount of the future, and more lenses are being released that way. It is an incredible set, sort of a base set of six lenses, plus there's going to be extra focal lengths they're adding on, starting as wide as 10.5. They all cover full frame, and then going as long as, I want to say 180. I'll have to double check that, check the long side, but it is... it's a lot. It's, God, no, sorry. I take that back. They go all the way up to 250, plus there's a set of doublers. So yeah, it goes 150, 200. Anyway, it's a huge set of lenses. The initial six lens set is, about $86,000 US, which is a relative bargain compared to what the signature primes are. Of course, these are professional lenses. These are not like indie film lenses. These are not the type of thing that, you know, a couple of guys are going to run around their backyard most likely to go shoot something. But they're all more or less the same size. They're all more or less the same T-stop. They're all T21. And they seem to have a really solid build quality. I think that these are going to be a hit. I know they're being introduced at a difficult time in this industry where people are probably not looking to spend a bunch of money since production is slow. But maybe with these new tax incentives, maybe people will get back in the habit of purchasing new gear and getting the ball rolling again. Anyway, I'm excited for these new Enso lenses. I'm glad that Airy introduced them. There's some pretty incredible lenses out there. Yeah. And these also look like they're just going to add to the legacy of Airy as sort of this incredible, you know, innovative company in the space. So anyway, Ben.
I can't think of a company that has been innovative in the cinema world as long as consistently as Airy. They are always 10 steps ahead of everybody in terms of this kind of stuff. And You're not going to go on a professional set and not see Aries.
And now, Short Ends.
All right, so Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsessions. Do you have a short end this week, something you are obsessed about?
I have a thing that, like, I have a curiosity that I wanted to mention.
Okay.
And it's it does involve AI, but not in, it's interesting. Okay, so it's called Shotcraft, craft with a K. Mm-hmm. So shot, it's like craft work. Shotcraft is an AI assistant to help you make a shot list for your film. Hmm. And I signed up for kind of a free trial to see what it would do. And I have to say that my initial impression was kind of cool, kind of basic. But like I've watched some videos of the people who created it and I feel like they have an interesting path forward. So basically what you do is you upload a PDF of your script or you upload you can even just copy and paste text. It doesn't need to be formatted in the form of a script. And then their AI analyzes it and comes back to you with a completely customizable by you pitch for how to cover your scene.
Interesting.
And so like if you say, you know, if there's a line in your script that says like, A hand picks up the knife, it's going to give you a close-up insert of that. And I sort of feel like I ran an episode of 20 Seconds to Live that we made years ago through it just to see if it would be anything like what we did or, you know, if it would give me a confusing pile of crap. And no, it was fine. And I think that there are a few things that I think that are interesting about it. So watching the guy who created Shotcraft, I watched a couple of videos on their YouTube channel, and it's like they're trying to create, it's sort of like the notebook LM of shot listing, if that, not to strain the idea, but the idea is like it's not to do the creative work for you. The creative work is the fun part, but it's to take out the grunt work from the creative process. So it's basically to be like, here's your basic coverage, customize it however you want. go into more detail however you want. Attach pictures if you want, like go on location and take pictures with your phone and add them to it.
Hmm.
Now, that's all cool. There are already tools like that, like ShotLister or the one that I use, which is ShotDesigner. To me, ShotDesigner is more useful than this currently. But what's interesting is that, like, watching this guy did a thing at NAB, and you can, it's only like 8 minutes long. You can watch the presentation on YouTube. I thought it was interesting where he's like, it will learn your taste. So, like, let's say you're in the Wes Anderson school of very symmetrical center framed shots, and you like, it can't currently do this, but their path that they want to go forward on is that it eventually learns your habits and kind of pitches what you would probably do.
Hmm.
Now, I feel to a certain degree, I get a little like, what do I do? Like, you know, like I want to push back on that a little bit, but also everyone does have a bag of tricks, and the bag of tricks will probably get you through most days, depending on what you're doing. And it's an interesting idea. Also, just as a straight up, just like tool for writing out a shot list and having a very accessible shot list there for your set is always helpful. Not everyone does it, and I think that all of these tools. I think this is why I landed on ShotDesigner as my tool of choice. Is that like all of these tools kind of focus you down a path of doing it their way. And I feel like ShotDesigner gives you like just a random suite of tools to use however the hell you feel like using them. And I feel like that suits me more, which doesn't mean that it suits everybody more. But I'm interested to see if ShotCraft becomes sort of the strata of director and shooting prep apps, in that it like starts figuring out stuff that's repetitive that you'd have to go back to, or like starts taking boring tasks out of that process.
Hmm.
So anyway, I don't think right now it's something that I would lean on for a shoot, but it's something that I'm interested enough in what they're planning to do that I might consider it the next time I had a big-ish shoot, you know? Enough on that. What is your pet obsession this week?
Well, I've actually been thinking a lot about probe lenses. And I know probe lenses have kind of an unfortunate name. I think people, when they think of probe, they I don't know what they would think of, alien probe.
Christopher Walken, yeah. Communion. Yeah,
exactly. That sort of thing.
X-Files. Yeah.
But Laowa, actually, you know, also now a sponsor of the show, but in no way influenced this becoming my short end. I was actually having lunch with Bill Totolo this week when I was in Los Angeles. And
that's our second Bill Totolo mention this week.
I know. Bill Totolo is getting all the love this week, but he showed me.
No love for Charles Papert. Up yours, Charles. Go on. Ilya.
So Bill showed me again, he pulled out this, his phone, and he showed me some stuff that he did recently on, the Laowa Pro Tube. I think the name is Pro Tube is actually probably how they pronounce it. Set of probe lenses. It's three probe lenses, and they're a Speedy T8. And of course, anyone who's into photography or videography or cinematography understands how fast a T8 is. Not particularly fast, but it's way, way faster. For a probe lens, it's actually not too bad. There's a previous version that was a T14. So this is like, you know, positively quick compared to that.
I remember years ago going to a seminar about the Fraser lens. I don't know if you remember that. I think it's still around.
I used the Fraser lens on multiple jobs back in the day.
Thing. It's an amazing accomplishment, but it was like an F16 or something ridiculous.
Yeah, and there are other probe lenses out there, but I gotta say the price of the Laowa one is pretty cheap, and a lot of tabletop work is getting used with it now, and it just goes to show that
how cheap is pretty cheap.
Well, I think each lens starts at about $2,800, so it's not like exactly like, you know, it's not as cheap as.
I mean, that's cheap as shit for a professional grade lens for a probe lens.
PL mount probe lens. It was up to a set for like $8,500. You know, of course, Hot Rod Cameras sells all these things. We usually have demos in stock. We have a whole like a tabletop production area we've been building lately with these things called performing rigs. Performing rigs like shoot serial into the air, and you've got a slow motion, you know, camera there, and you can, you know, do all these different things. And we can put the probe lenses on it to demonstrate, like, you know, this. Sort of
I just imagine like putting a probe lens on a Phantom camera at that f-stop and how much more light you would need. And
you need a lot of light. The tabletop work in slow motion gets blasted with light. But regardless, these lenses, which are relatively cheap, have kind of revolutionized a whole level of tabletop production. And it's just sort of something quiet too, because tabletop production doesn't get exactly the love and attention. Most of it has to do with commercial work, but not always. And there's some pretty reasonably priced tools that are doing incredible stuff. The stuff that Bill showed me looked amazing. And of course, he told me sort of like, you know, the behind the scenes of what they had to go through to get the shot. But I was just thinking that, like, if you go back 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it would have been an entirely different thing just to do what they did. So it's like, it's really become, tabletop work has become so much more accessible to a group of people thanks to things like this. And there's a really, there's an awful lot of really cool stuff that could happen, including, I know that it's getting more esoteric and AI threatens it, but claymation or stop motion animation, different types of, you know, techniques that, that are all involved, you know, I'm going to say like, characters that are between like 6 and 20 inches tall. So there's some really amazing work that's going on all the time. And these type of lenses make that all the more, you know, accessible and amazing.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we should probably wrap it up. Ilya, who do we need to thank before we move on? Oh, wait, before I even do that, where do people find you?
They can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Yeah, I'm also on the socials, so at Ilya Friedman on Instagram, and I'm one of only a couple Ilya Friedmans on LinkedIn, so you can track me down there.
I'm going to find the other Ilya Friedmans. And
yeah, every once in a while we message each other. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me and the Ben Rocks do that too sometimes. Yeah. There's a few of us.
All right, Ben, where can people find you?
You can find me at benrock.com, which is not owned by any of the other Ben Rocks. Or the boat company. Find me at benrock.com. You can check out my reel, blah, blah, blah. So who do we need to thank?
Hey, let's thank Alana Cody. She produced this episode and...
Holy crap. She's working so hard on this right now.
It's award season. There's stuff happening. I'm going to go see there's a screening in Portland for a movie. I'm going to go see it on Friday. I can't believe it. A press screening. That almost never happens. So
that's cool. I had two screenings last week. So
yeah. So Friday I'm going to a press screening. Alana got notified of it and let me know. So that's cool. Okay. Then we got to thank Kay Zalatrachi, who made the music that you hear in this episode. And at the beginning of every episode, the theme music, all the music that you hear. And then of course, Michael Dispenza, who is editing this episode and cutting us to reasonable lengths of time. And so, Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Take us out.
Thanks for tuning in.
Well done. It's only a little cheesy. It's really good. So, okay.
All right, cool.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.